In the midst of the Great Depression, cereal manufacturer Kellogg's switched to a shorter 6-hour day. And this continued a trend that seemed inevitable. People would work less and less. But economic policies, management strategies, and cultural attitudes changed. The story of the rise and fall of Kellogg's 6-hour day is a microcosm of these changes, as well as of our attitudes about the roles of money, leisure, work, and women and men. This is Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. In the book, Kellogg's 6-Hour Day, historian Benjamin Klein Honeycutt shares his findings in studying Kellogg's shorter workday. His main sources of information were 434 interviews conducted by the Women's Bureau of the Department of Labor, 124 interviews he himself conducted of workers, and 241 responses to a survey he had sent. What follows is a summary of the story and Honeycutt's findings. During the Great Depression, American businesses took on a policy of work sharing. The idea was that fewer would be unemployed if everyone shared jobs, more workers working fewer hours. So on December 1st, 1930, W.K. Kellogg changed most departments in Kellogg's Battle Creek, Michigan plant from 3 8-hour shifts to 4 6-hour shifts. This continued a decades-long trend of shorter working hours. Labor activist William Heighton had written in 1827 that the workday should be reduced from 12 hours to 10, 8, and so on, until the development and progress of science have reduced human labor to its lowest terms. John Stuart Mill had written in 1848 about his vision for a stationary state. After necessities were met, people would seek progress in mental, moral, and social realms. John Maynard Keynes would predict in the same year Kellogg switched to 6 hours, 1930, that we'd have a 15-hour work week by 2030. George Bernard Shaw and Julian Jaxley had predicted a maximum 2-hour workday by the end of the 1900s. Other businesses followed Kellogg's lead. A survey by the Industrial Conference Board in 1931 estimated 50% of American businesses had shortened hours to save jobs. President Herbert Hoover was considering making a 6-hour day a national policy. In the 1932 presidential campaign, both major parties were advocating shorter hours. Not only did the 6-hour day help create jobs, it seemed for a while like it was a better business policy. Forbes called it the topic of discussion in the business world. Business Week concluded it was profitable. The New York Times called it a complete success. Factory and Industrial Management magazine called the 6-hour day the biggest piece of industrial news since Ford announced his $5 a day policy. At Kellogg's, 15% more shredded wheat cases were being packed per hour. Profits had doubled in 1931 versus 3 years prior. After 5 years with the 6-hour day, overhead costs had been reduced 25%, labor costs 10%, with 41% fewer accidents. W.K. Kellogg said, "We can afford to pay as much for 6 hours as we formerly paid for 8." Now, that should be taken with a grain of salt. W.K. Kellogg took pride in crafting a public image as a welfare capitalist, as evinced by the full-page newspaper ads he took out, boasting how Kellogg's had done its part. In reality, nearly half of workers later surveyed recalled that their wages were reduced. In 1943, President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed an executive order to direct the maximum amount of manpower towards supporting the country's fight in World War II. Kellogg's responded in kind by temporarily returning to 8-hour shifts. This was actually an opportunity the company had been looking for. Kellogg's management and that at other companies were beginning to resent the 6-hour day, and workers were becoming divided over whether they wanted a shorter workday or more pay. In 1936, the National Council of Grain Producers had started a union chapter in Kellogg's Battle Creek headquarters. W.K. Kellogg had been proud to pay what he considered the best hourly wages in town. During the first meeting with union officers, he wept and kept saying, "If only they had come to me, I would have given them what they wanted." After this point, the relationship between Kellogg's workers and management became adversarial. WK had left in 1937 after the union came in, and at that point, the union leaders had been pushing to not only have a six-hour day in which they could earn a bonus based upon productivity, but they also had wanted time and a half pay for working more than 6 hours in a day. Honeycutt wrote, "More than any other demand, this position would come to haunt Kellogg workers." Demanding overtime pay on a six-hour day helped turn management against the shorter workday and create a rift between workers who wanted higher wages and workers who wanted shorter hours. In the larger relationship between management and labor, the American Federation of Labor introduced a bill in Congress prohibiting goods produced by workers working more than 30 hours a week from being traded across state lines. Honeycutt cites this as having shifted the business world's stance on shorter hours from support to opposition. In 1938, Kellogg's management deepened the divide between six-hour and eight-hour workers by proposing they be allowed to schedule a 40-hour week during periods of heavy production. Overtime became available instead of a productivity bonus. Senior workers had priority access to overtime, and so they lost interest in the productivity bonus. So in the early 1940s, before the war, worker opinions were shifting to view shorter hours not as a benefit, but as instead an exploitation of workers, making them bear the brunt of fighting unemployment. And Kellogg's was actively campaigning against shorter days, asking workers to consider how much more they would make working 8 hours. Meanwhile, the business world was shifting from a scientific management philosophy to a human relations management philosophy. Scientific management practitioners were obsessed with efficiency, but human relations management practitioners were more interested in imbuing work with joy and meaning, making work its own reward. The human relations management school envisioned that as work brought satisfaction, engineers and scientists would lead society into an orderly world where desires met obligations, consumption met production, and work and leisure merged. According to human relations management, time away from work and consumption was a relic of an illogical past. Instead of work becoming obsolete, giving way to more freedom, work would become the center of life and help us ascend Maslow's hierarchy. After the war, many departments resumed six-hour shifts, but six-hour workers slowly lost their beloved shorter shifts over the following decades. Central to this struggle was how workers viewed leisure. Kellogg's workers had previously voted to essentially buy shorter working hours, being paid less overall in exchange for more leisure time. Employees used their time to improve their homes, go hunting, and grow and can food in their gardens and spend time volunteering in their communities. But slowly, workers became less interested in having time away from work. One explanation from a worker Honeycutt interviewed was, people were now outsourcing all things they used to spend time on. One place they were outsourcing to was mass media. Sports had been such serious business amongst Kellogg's employees, they had hired semi-pro softball or basketball players to play on the teams. But why watch the company team play when you can watch pros on television? One former six-hour worker bemoaned that even conversation had been outsourced to radio or television talk show hosts. The question, 6 hours or eight, became a gender issue. Early on, both men and women were interested in six-hour shifts. Three-fourths of men voted for six-hour shifts in 1937, but half of men were working eight-hour shifts by 1947. The six-hour departments began to be referred to as girls' departments, doing women's work. Management also assigned sick and disabled employees to the six-hour departments. Men who chose to work 6 hours were labeled sissies, lazy, or weird. Honeycutt's interpretation was that men were increasingly seeing work as a place for control and identity, that many hadn't known what to do with themselves after their shorter shifts. They didn't like spending more time at home and being assigned chores by their wives or hearing what they considered to be gossip. As a result, men placed more importance on working longer hours, or at least appearing to. Honeycutt said men he interviewed commonly claimed to have gotten second jobs while they were working 6 hours. How often is commonly, he doesn't say, but he points out only 35% ever did get second jobs. This attitude, which we might today call toxic masculinity, extended into attitudes about leisure. When asked why they preferred longer hours, men spoke of necessity and used dramatic language, saying they had to keep the wolf from the door, feed the family, and put bread on the table. When Honeycutt pointed out to men who had been working in the 1950s that workers in the Great Depression had been willing to take pay cuts to have more free time, he says they got defensive, lectured him on the facts of life economically, called 6 hours nonsense or a pipe dream, or dismissed the question as silly. While Honeycutt's conclusions here are plausible, it really did seem like he wanted it to be true, and he didn't really present the men's attitudes scientifically. There's no mention of what earnings were relative to cost of living, no acknowledgement of what these men's roles might have been truthfully in the economics of their homes. There's not even a mention of how throwing thousands of young men into the meat grinder that was World War II, tasked with saving the world, might have affected their own perceptions of what was expected of them. Though he did present a story of one man who had found that the extra money he made going back to 8 hours was due to his ex-wife as alimony. In the 1970s, Kellogg's women worked with a local women's rights group who presented the case that six-hour shifts were a sexist ploy meant to subjugate women. They demanded management allow women to have full-time jobs. Kellogg's posted notices in the plant claiming that to make pay comparable, they were opening up 8-hour departments to women. In doing so, they skirted the issue. The activists had wanted not just comparable hours, but comparable hourly pay. Workers who stuck with the 6-hour shift, who Honeycutt calls 6-hour mavericks, were about a quarter of the Kellogg's workforce from 1957 into the 1980s. The union worked according to a department-by-department vote on the length of the day, so long as the 6-hour workers didn't interfere with the union majority's strategy to try to get higher wages and more benefits. Overtime had previously been thought of as a penalty to the company for being understaffed, but it became a way for workers to earn more money while the company's staffing requirements remained flexible. According to Honeycutt, with overtime instead of productivity bonuses, workers were less motivated and careful. The company had to resort to being more controlling, motivating workers with fines, threats, and firings. The increased benefits the union had fought for over the years may have worked against the 6-hour shift. The final nail in the coffin was driven in 1984 when Kellogg's threatened to relocate if workers didn't vote to abandon the 6-hour shift. So the 6-hour workers gave in and voted to give it up. Some retired, some worked 8 hours, but the coffin in which this nail was driven was both figurative and literal. The 6-hour workers held a funeral, building a full-size cardboard coffin painted black, placed on the workroom floor, a cutout skeleton placed inside. Thus reversed a trend that had held on for over 150 years. The idea of less work and more leisure gave way to a stable amount of work and more consumption. It's tempting to blame the death of the 6-hour shift on one of many juicy narratives. You could say people forgot how to spend their leisure time. You could say people were overly materialistic and wanted more money instead of time. You could say toxic masculinity and a patriarchal society tipped the scales so those who wanted to work shorter hours were no longer in the majority. You could say the unions got too demanding and sabotaged the long-fought battle for a shorter working day. All these are probably true to an extent. Ultimately, businesses want to, need to maximize profit. They have to offer benefits to employees to stay competitive. To offer those benefits profitably, they need more work from fewer workers. If you believe the efficient market hypothesis, if a shorter workday were indeed more profitable, some business would beat its competitors by offering one, and other businesses would follow suit. So far, that hasn't happened. If, as I believe, creativity becomes more important, productivity will be about mind management, not time management, and a more relaxed work schedule will be embraced. But probably not for boxing cornflakes. This episode is essentially a summary of the book Kellogg's 6-Hour Day by Benjamin Klein Honeycutt. The book is very dense and written in an academic style, so I can't recommend it unless you really want to dig deep into questions about work and leisure. It's a provocative story that makes you wonder if we could be living in a world where a 6-hour day is standard. But it sounds like it wasn't even close.
Love Your Work is brought to you exclusively by our Patreon supporters, including top supporters Jeffrey Mason and Bob Rosen.
The theme music for Love Your Work is At Sea by Durena from the album About Everything and More by arrangement with Deep Elm Records at deepelm.com. Love Your Work is a production of Cataby, Inc.